Good afternoon, everybody. Two applause for coming in July. Weekly book club class, The Life and Times of Joseph B. Soloveitchik. I promised you a good one. I'm going to deliver. Let's get right to it. We left off on page 27, the biography of the Rav, and towards the bottom of the page, we pick it up. You know, I was doing the middle of the page. In Berlin, Germany, where Rabbi Soloveitchik had gone to study at the University of Berlin, where he majored in philosophy. In Berlin, the young Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik sought out other devotees and interpreters of Torah Judaism. Among his contemporaries at the university was Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who was to succeed his father-in-law as the Lubavitcher Rebbe in 1950. Excuse me, decades later, in 1980, the Rav was to attend the public Hasidic gathering, the Fabringen, in honor of the Rebbe's 30th anniversary as the head of Lubavitch. I've seen the picture of that. During the 1926-27 academic year, the Rav also ordered classes at the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary for the training of Orthodox rabbis, which had been founded by Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer in 1873. Here, he gained insights into German Orthodoxy, which had inscribed Torah and Derech Eretz, or Torah and Civilization, on its banner. The most profound intellectual relationship that the Rav forged in Berlin was with Rabbi Chaim Heller, who was born 1878 and passed in 1960. Rabbi Heller was a unique Torah scholar who combined vast erudition of the traditional type in rabbinic literature with a thorough knowledge of modern methods of textual research. Rabbi Heller established an advanced yeshiva, the Beis HaMedrash HaElyon, in Berlin. The goal of this institution was to combine the intensive study of classical rabbinic literature with the modern scientific approach to research in Bible and Talmud. The school did not flourish due to the paucity of students who could satisfy its high standards. It's kind of like, if you were to ask me, this is me interjecting right now, if you were to ask me what this is all about, is it Yeshiva University's Bernard, you know, Revel Graduate School being offered to young Yeshiva guys? I guess so. Is it like your JTS, but with an Orthodox angle to it? It seems like that. I've often wondered how JTS, you know, how does that function? You accept upon yourself the study of the Bible, the Torah, and you're studying the mitzvahs. On the other hand, you're uncovering academic theories which do not accept the Bible as written by God. So how do you walk that impossible tightrope? They don't do a very good job of it because they're falling apart. No Jew is going to be in both camps. It's a very, very, it's a near, it seems to me anyway, at its face, a near contradictory kind of a movement. Now, there are academics out there who are Orthodox. I've never really spoken to them. If they compartmentalize things, I mean, how do they do it? Shapiro comes to mind. Schiffman comes to mind a little bit. But they're both Orthodox guys who just kind of think, if it's just take everything in stride. You know, they have their beliefs, their personal Orthodox beliefs. And whatever the academics write, they write. You know, these people read it, and they just keep moving. At all events, this school in Berlin was going to not flourish very well because of a lack of students who could satisfy its high standards. Although the Rav was never a formal student in Rabbi Heller's school, he became a disciple of Rabbi Heller's. And their relationship developed into a paternal bond. Decades later, top of page 28, decades later, the Rav's hesped of Rabbi Chaim Heller was widely acclaimed as one of his most inspiring, and creative expositions in the disciplines of homiletics and theology. I got to look that up. I got to read that hesped, if we can, if it's around. A resident of Berlin in this period thus described his memories of a frequently observed street scene. Quote, in those years, one could frequently encounter three men, walking along the streets of Berlin, who stood out even amongst Berlin's jury, which was certainly not short of eminent personalities. The three men were Joseph Dov Soloveitchik, with Professor Eugene Mittwoch, who was born 1876 and passed in 1942, an Orthodox Jew and a distinguished Orientalist, and with Rabbi Chaim Heller, one of the great scholars of his time, sometimes accompanied by Rabbi Dr. Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, who was born 1885 and passed in 1966, rector of the Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary. By the way, Rabbi Dr. Mark Shapiro, who we have hosted as a guest scholar in residence at Gulf Meadows Synagogue, wrote his PhD thesis on from yeshiva to, oh goodness, I've not the book, so I'm not 100% certain of the title, but from yeshiva to modernity or something like that, the life and times of Rabbi Dr. Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, the Sridei Eish. And I think that Rabbi Weinberg gets very, very little coverage in yeshiva circles today, because he kind of moved, I guess, from, if he was ever in Germany, and he went east, and he went to the Lutfische yeshivas, and then he went west again, and apparently he became the rector of the Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary, not exactly the Volozhiny yeshiva or the Telz yeshiva, a little bit more modernistic, and that's why Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, the Baal Sridei Eish, is just basically, you know, he's just not really kind of discussed. You don't really hear of him. Maybe in a place like Chappelle's, where I hung out, maybe who knows, maybe Merkez Harav, they take a look at him. I don't know, but it was Shapiro's PhD thesis at Harvard, and it was published, and that began his prodigious publishing career ever since. We continue, middle of page 28. While in Berlin, the Rav displayed sensitivity toward manuscripts and the establishment of proper texts. The Vilna Gaon, who lived throughout the 18th century, had made this science one of the touchstones of his method of study. It's an amazing thing. But the Vilna Gaon, for all he was opposed to the Haskalah, and no doubt he was, but the Vilna Gaon, I've got to say this, I'm not sure if I'm accurate in saying it like this, but maybe he was affected by that aspect of the Haskalah. That aspect of the Haskalah which said, do we have the very best text? Let's go back and see what the original manuscripts say. Let's not trust the Rahm brothers. The publishing house. Let's go see what the actual Kitvei Yad, handwritten manuscripts, say for themselves. So we have a copy, Rabbi Balk donated a copy of Tosefta Kipshuta by Shaul Lieberman of the JTS Seminary. And over there, he takes a look at the Viennese manuscript, the London manuscript, the Erfurt manuscript on the Tosefta. And he also the Geniza, the Cairo Geniza, gets the fragments of the Tosefta out of the Cairo Geniza. And he makes an incredible contribution to scholarship, having looked at those original manuscripts. That's a modern academic approach. The Vilna Gaon was very into it. Later years, the yeshivas have not been into that. There's nobody that I know, no yeshiva, sends guys to HUC Library or to JTS or Hebrew University to see what the original manuscript says. They just take for granted that whatever is written in the published text that they have is the text. That's an approach, too. I mean, it's time-saving. But if you're going to be a man of, you know, Mada, if you're going to be a man of the Wissenschaft des Judentums, the scientific study of Judaism, you got to see what the original manuscripts say. That's not the interest of the yeshiva movement today. At all events, we continue. The Vilna Gaon had made this science, that is to say manuscripts, one of the touchstones of his method of study, but it was generally neglected in the yeshiva method of study. the Rav's uncle, Rabbi Menachem Krakowski, he had authored the Sefer Avodat HaMelech on Rambam's Mishneh Torah, his Code of Jewish Law. This volume, Avodat HaMelech, was unique in rabbinic circles since it combined the traditional yeshiva approach with a keen appreciation for correct textual structure. The Rav was cited 6 times in that book, Avodat HaMelech, for having checked ancient manuscripts in the Berlin libraries for their variant textual readings. How about that? How about using your time in Berlin well by going into the bowels of the libraries and checking out manuscripts and seeing how they compare to the published word of today? That's pretty good. Okay. Rabbi Soloveitchik married Tanya Levitt, who was born 1904 and passed in 1967. And he married her in 1931. Her background was similar to that of her husband, in that she had been raised in Eastern Europe in Vilna and sought higher education in Western Europe. She had received a PhD in education from the University of Vienna and was to ably assist her husband in all his endeavors until her death. In 1932, the young couple, together with their firstborn child, emigrated to the United States. The Rav's family had already arrived in the United States, where his father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, had been the head of the Talmudical faculty of the Rabbi Isaac O'Connor Theological Seminary in the Washington Heights section of Manhattan since 1929. In 1945, the New York State Board of Regents granted university status to the school, then popularly known as the Yeshiva. Top page 29. Under the Immigration Act of 1924, this was the Taylor Act, which restricted Eastern European Jewish immigration by a lot. It really put the brakes on it. For the previous 50 years, Jews were streaming into the United States. From 1880, in Russia, Poland, Lithuania, they were leaving by the droves. Couldn't get away fast enough from the pogroms and the insanity of the Tsar. And then in 1924, the Taylor Act kicked in and really put the brakes on that continued immigration. Under the Immigration Act of 1924, any person who had been a, quote, minister of any religious denomination or professor of a college, academy, seminary, or university, end quote, such a person was permitted to enter the United States, quote, solely for the purpose of continuing this vocation, end quote. In accordance with these guidelines, the Hebrew Theological College in Chicago, that's of course known as the Skokie Yeshiva, at the request of the Union of Orthodox Rabbis, Skokie Yeshiva facilitated the immigration of Rabbi Soloveitchik and his immediate family. However, due to the financial difficulties engendered by the Depression, the school could not afford to engage the Rav. They could not honor their commitment to him. They couldn't ultimately hire him. The course of events is summarized here by Rabbi Oscar Fassman, later the president of the Hebrew Theological College, during the years 1946 to 1964, and for whom they have named the high school. It is now known as the Fassman Yeshiva High School. He writes as follows, Rabbi Fassman of Skokie Yeshiva does, quote, indeed, to preserve an interesting note in history, I record that Rabbi Joseph Job Soloveitchik, who was considered the leading international Orthodox authority, was brought to this country with immigration papers issued by the Hebrew Theological College. Upon his arrival at Ellis Island in 1932, however, my alma mater sent word to the Union of Orthodox Rabbis that it was unable to pay his salary and a position on the East Coast should be found for him. End quote. By the way, it is the case that his brother, Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, ultimately I just don't know when. I simply do not know when. I don't know too much about Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, but he did indeed join the faculty of, this is my understanding anyway, he was associated, if I'm not mistaken, with Skokie, with the Skokie Yeshiva. He also did a little bit of teaching at Yeshiva University in New York. That's true, too. I don't know exactly what the arrangement was. I do know that there were times when he gave lectures at YU. That's my understanding as well. But I think it was more informal. I do think that he had a more formalistic arrangement with the Skokie Yeshiva to be discussed and to be determined. There might be something about it later on this book. We continue. A few months after his arrival, the younger Soloveitchik was invited to become rabbi. This is Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, of course. He was invited to become rabbi of the Va'ad Ha'ir of Boston, Massachusetts. This fellowship, which united many of the Orthodox Boston synagogues, was dedicated to sustaining Torah study and observance on the communal scene. The Va'ad Ha'ir, later succeeded by the Chevra Shas of Boston, engaged the Rav and brought him to Boston, which was to remain his home throughout the rest of his life. The Rav's main responsibilities were to provide spiritual leadership for the community and to deliver discourses in the various synagogues on the appropriate occasions. He was installed in his new post on December 11th, 1932, by, can you guess? Cincinnatians, can you guess? Yep, by Rabbi Eliezer Silver, who was born 1881 and passed 1968, who was then the president of the Union of Orthodox Rabbis. Top page 30. The Rav was soon caught up in the vexations and burdensome quests of the American Orthodox rabbinate in that period. Boston had long experienced disputes among its rabbis in the area of kashrus supervision. The new rabbi not only endured these difficulties, but also encountered the resentment of some of the elder rabbis in the greater Boston area because of his attempts to establish higher kashrus standards and more humane working conditions for the shochtim, for the slaughterers of the, usually of the chickens. There was also opposition to the Rav's upgrading of kashrus standards from proprietors of the kosher meat and poultry industries. Well, that would make some sense, wouldn't it? I mean, they did that in New York as well, to Rabbi Jacob Joseph. Excuse me. As the first and only chief rabbi of New York, to whom the famous Rabbi Jacob Joseph School was named, Rabbi Jacob Joseph attempted to raise kosher standards, and that gained him no small amount of hatred from these proprietors of the chicken industries and the chicken fields and so on, the slaughterhouses and whatnot. They really resented it. So trying to upgrade kosher standards is almost always going to find you pitted against these proprietors of the kosher meat and poultry industries who are always trying to maximize money and save a buck. And so we continue with our book. These guys, these proprietors, they resented the extra costs that would incur by implementing Rabbi Soloveitchik's regulations. This simmering resentment later became a source of acute pain and distress for the Rav. In 1939, the Rav acceded to the requests of the representatives of the poultry shachtim that he reorganized their association. Exploited by their employers, the shachtim were paid meager salaries and made to work long hours. Some worked 24 hours at a stretch. And under these conditions, the slaughtering rituals could not be executed properly. Not kidding. As part of this, I'm sorry, as part of his reformation of the Shechita process in Boston, the Rav insisted on the use of kosher bands or rings on poultry slaughtered by the reorganized Shechtim under his supervision. These bands indicated the poultry was kosher and also minimized the possibility of fabrications. The expense of the bands, which would have to be 1 cent per fowl, was to be borne by the proprietors and not the consumers. In 1941, accusations were made against the Rav that he was personally reaping monetary gain from this system at the expense of the Jewish community. In addition, the Rav was accused of not declaring this income and therefore of tax evasion. These charges, can you even begin to believe this? I never knew this until I read this an hour ago. I had no idea that this man went through this. Accusations that he was personally reaping monetary gain from the system and he's making money and not declaring his income and it's tax evasion. Oh my God. Unbelievable. I never heard it. Generally not discussed. I mean, you never read it. Excuse me. A little phlegm. These charges were brought to the attention of the Attorney General of Massachusetts, Robert Bushnell. At his behest, Judge Abraham K. Cohen investigated the charges. After a meticulous 14-month investigation of the entire kosher poultry industry, the judge totally cleared Rabbi Soloveitchik. With a sense of deep indignation, Judge Cohen declared that the charges against Rabbi Soloveitchik were totally untrue and sheer fabrications. Moreover, he declared, quote, "Those who originated the charges knew that they were unfounded. The evil rumors were spread with malice, and the rabbi was dreadfully abused and baselessly accused." End quote. Top 31. Judge Cohen stated that the general kosher situation in Boston was a, quote, "disgrace to its Jewish community," end quote. He cited a letter from Swift and Company, which declared that during the 9 years that Rabbi Soloveitchik had supervised their kosher production, it was carried out with, quote, "scrupulous integrity, unquestioned probity, and rare efficiency," end quote. In a letter to Rabbi Herbert Goldstein, a prominent New York rabbi, Judge Cohen summarized his conclusions, quote, "I feel, however, that it is not improper for me to say to you that the report embodying the results of the investigation very specifically clears Rabbi Soloveitchik of the charges thus made and, on the contrary, commends him for his honesty of purpose and the order which he brought out of the chaos which existed when he undertook the supervision of the slaughter of kosher poultry and the marketing thereof. He did not have the supervision of the slaughtering of kosher cattle except in a very small extent. He did not participate in any, quote, racket, end quote, and on the contrary, served the community in connection with the slaughter of poultry without any compensation to him whatsoever," end quote. On November 3rd, 1943, Judge Cohen addressed the Greater Boston Rabbinical Association about the local kosher situation. His address was summarized by the Boston Jewish Advocate. Number one, the judge, with a sense of deep indignation, stated that the charges against Rabbi Soloveitchik were utterly untrue, that moreover, his accusers knew that they were unfounded and made them in malice with the intent to harm his reputation. Number two, that there are some individuals without scholarship and even less character who assume wrongfully the title of rabbi. Such persons acquire a small organization, call it a synagogue, and obtain for themselves official status, being untrained, undisciplined, and irresponsible. They are in no way prepared to serve the needs of the community. Top 32. Number three, before Rabbi Soloveitchik assumed the supervision of the slaughtering of kosher poultry, the shachtim were definitely exploited. The hours were unduly long, some toiling 24 hours a stretch. Their salary is minimal. Rabbi Soloveitchik was then invited to put order into the chaos. The rabbi agreed to do so, provided that kosher bands were used, since the rabbi, as well as others in our community, knew that an enormous amount of misrepresentation was practiced. After Rabbi Soloveitchik undertook this task, the living conditions of the shachtim were considerably improved, and the standard of kashrus raised. They began to receive a living wage and began to work decent hours. Number four, the expense of the bands, which cost 1 cent per chicken, was borne by the proprietors of the slaughterhouses and not by the consumers. All monies obtained from the sale of these bands, approximately $15,000 a year, were spent on the purchase of the bands, mashkichim, ritual supervisors. Also, they went towards aiding Orthodox rabbis who were in need, sick benefits, etc. Rabbi Soloveitchik did not obtain even 1 cent from these monies. The financial statement published by the shachtim in the Jewish Advocate in May 1941 was correct in all details. End quote. Despite his total vindication in Judge Cohen's report, the personal strain engendered by the false accusations and the lengthy investigation greatly influenced the Rav's public posture during the ensuing decades. At times, he instinctively shied away from public controversy and unnecessary pronouncements which could engender dissent. Following these events, the Rav made the study and teaching of Torah the focal point of his life and minimized his involvement with kashrus supervision. He would often cite this change in his priorities as the blessing that resulted from these tribulations. He declared that the investigation had taught him that kashrus supervision was not the area to which he should devote his main energies. It was rather with the study and teaching of Torah that he should preoccupy himself. Top 33. In Boston, the Rav was also introduced to the ignorance of the American Jewish community. Coming from Europe, he was at times shocked by his initial encounters with the Jewish illiteracy of the average American Jew. Reminiscing years later, he would regale audiences with his description of the first wedding he officiated in Boston. The groom did not know whether he was a Kohen, Levi, or Yisrael. At other times, the Rav would describe the synagogue president who had unfolded a newspaper and studied the latest financial information while Megillas Esther was being read in the synagogue on the night of Purim. Rabbi Soloveitchik's main achievements in Boston were in the area of Torah education. In 1937, he founded the Maimonides School, the first Jewish day school in the New England area. It began with 6 students, and its first location was at the Young Israel of Roxbury. There was much opposition to the new school because the great majority of Boston Jewry considered it, quote, a return to the ghetto, end quote. The early years of the school were filled with daily difficulties. At times, the initial class had to continue its studies in the Soloveitchik home. Rabbi William Millen, a member of the first class, later recalled that the heating system of the Young Israel of Roxbury routinely broke down. When this happened, the students marched through the New England chill to the warmth of the nearby Soloveitchik home. The Rav and his wife, quote, opened their door and their hearts to the pupils. The children huddled on the living room sofa and learning resumed. Nothing seemed different, Vermillion declared. The kids smiled and Rabbi Bernstein continued with his lesson. We couldn't fully appreciate the Herculean task that the Rav undertook, but the kind of love that he gave to it. Wow. Wow. Dedicated to a school to benefit the children of others. That's me talking, not the book. That's a real man. Continuing. During the initial years of Maimonides, it was only the resolute spirit and vision of the Rav and his wife that enabled the school to take root. Dr. Atara Soloveitchik-Torsky later recalled that her father, quote, appreciated those people who gave money, but he was much more appreciative of those who sent their children to the school. To send a child to an unknown, an unproven school was an act of faith. One stood to lose more than money. Here, you were risking the education of a child, end quote. Wow. Brave people. Top page 34. The Rav emerged as a visible force in the fundraising arena for Maimonides. Joseph Abelow recalled how his father, Rabbi Leo Abelow, who was a committee member of the Vat HaIr, which had brought the Rav to Boston, and later he'd be the president of the Chevra Shas. Rabbi Leo Abelow joined the Rav in fundraising missions for the school. Quote, Joseph Abelow recalling his father, I was always waiting for my father, Joseph speaking about Rabbi Leo. I was always waiting for my father to come home from going with the Rav collecting money. When a major gift came in, there was much glee. It was like a Yom Tov festival. Mrs. Dorothy Greenwald, a Maimonides parent, recalled how Tanya Soloveitchik also fought tenaciously to collect funds for the school. Quote, she solicited a contribution from someone who four or five times had refused. Asked why she would go back, Mrs. Soloveitchik responded, I did not do it for myself. I did it for the school. That person finally contributed large sums. It's not my first time reading this. I prepared about an hour ago, but it's difficult to get through it. I'm very touched by it. Didn't really know any of this. In other words, Soloveitchik's life is just shrouded in mystery. If you're in a certain schnitt of orthodoxy, you just don't know anything about him. I'm just so glad we're able to do this today together. We continue. Dr. Torsky explained that what happened to be fundraising savvy was actually hard work for her parents. Quote, they were not natural-born fundraisers. They had to go beyond their natural proclivities in doing this, end quote. It became a labor of love. Assisted by his adherents, the Rav forged ahead, and the Maimonides student body increased. The school accommodated the influx of new students by relocating from the Israel of Roxbury to the Adams Estate at the corner of Washington Street and Columbia Road in Dorchester, which was purchased in the early 1940s. The school now had six grades. In 1947, Maimonides moved ahead with the addition of the seventh and eighth grades. In 1950, the high school division opened. By now, the Adams Estate was too small. And after its sale, the school was housed in two buildings in Roxbury. The former Menorah Hebrew School on Elm Hill Avenue and the dilapidated Otis Field Street Hebrew School a few blocks away. In 1959, they were talking about, they said that this was the very first Jewish day school in the New England area. I guess it preceded the birth of the other schools I just mentioned, because in 37, Rabbi Soloveitchik founded it, and he founded it as a Jewish day school, as opposed to an afternoon, I presume, a post-public school afternoon Hebrew school program, which was always just very, very minimalistic, and still is. The Reform and Conservative movements are famous for minimizing Jewish education, even when they have the opportunity, they got the children. They'll do a post-public school thing or whatever. Always watered down, always taught by people who are uncredentialed, never doing Jewish texts. It's just absolutely painful. It's painful to see what 8 years of non-education can do to a kid. Walks out knowing nothing and cares about nothing. Knows some Israeli songs, a little bit about the Holocaust, and is a state of Israel. It's very nice to know that. But if that's all you know after 8 years, you've done nothing. It's very sad. Rabbi Soloveitchik made sure to do something about it. And they taught Torah in the Maimonides school. We continue. In 1959, Maimonides purchased its four-acre campus on Philbrick Road in Brookline. I spent a year, 1994 to 95, in Boston. And I was in a Lakewood, I was living on top of a Lakewood-style shul. And Maimonides school is pretty far away. I mean, it's not an easy walk from Chayotim to over there. It would have been a few miles, I think. I think so, anyway. So I didn't really go there. I was there once, I think. I went out with somebody, and I dropped her off. She was living in that area. Hard to remember exactly. But that's where Maimonides is right now, right in the heart of the Brookline Orthodox community. The staggered relocation to the modern new facility was completed in 1964 when the elementary wing reopened there. Top page 35. Not only was the Rav the guiding force of the religious studies curriculum, but he also supervised and sometimes changed the daily functioning of Maimonides. To ensure that the pupils learned to pray properly, he insisted that the school day begin with the morning chakras prayers rather than have the children pray at home in a misguided policy to save time. The Rav instituted formal classes on Chol HaMoed Sukkos to provide an opportunity for children from non-observant homes to eat in the sukkah and fulfill the mitzvah of Lulav and Esther. Yearly, on Erev Yom Kippur, the Rav addressed the high school students on the subject of tshuva and then davened the special Erev Yom Kippur mincha prayer with them. The Rav also pioneered in the Torah education of women and included the study of Talmud in their curriculum. For many years, the Rav devoted Friday mornings to classroom visits at Maimonides. Thus, over the decades, the guiding hand of the Rav shaped Maimonides as it expanded its activities and influence. The school gradually became the focal institution for Orthodox Judaism in the greater Boston area. That's very true for the modern Orthodox crowd in Boston. For the yeshiva crowd, it became ultimately the Torah Academy, which became that community's elementary school. And then terribly long ago, the Mesipta of Boston was formed. And so you've got a choice when you go to Boston. If you go to the modern Orthodox school, it's going to be Maimonides, co-ed from K through 12. If you go to the Torah Academy, it is, there's a, you know, girls' division, a boys' division, but they're separated. And you've got, obviously, an all-boys Mesipta of Boston. In later years, the Rav reflected on the new school's struggle to establish itself in the Boston Jewish community. Quote, when a new idea is thrust upon the world, it generally passes through three stages. First, it is scorned. Then, it is fought. And finally, it is accepted as self-evident. The scorn has long since been overcome. The struggle for survival has been gloriously won. And the concept of the Hebrew Day School as a vital force on the American Jewish scene has become dramatically self-evident. Hear, hear. End quote. There's no doubt. But the Hebrew Day School, as a movement, has taught tens of thousands of students, many, many of whom were given a thorough exposure to Judaism, many of whom remain in the Orthodox sphere. And without them, I don't even know where we would be today without a day school, a nationwide day school movement. You'd have far fewer from people. There might be a thriving Hasidic community, but you wouldn't have anything much more than that. I mean, without a day school, we would be the modern Orthodox community, and we would be the yeshiva community, for that matter. You know, maybe they would create their own chadarim, but a nationwide network of coast-to-coast schools affiliated with the Torah Masorah movement, which offered Jewish education to children of the community. They were like community schools that took in almost virtually everybody. If you're a Jewish kid, you're owed a Jewish education. Come on in. Amazing. It's an amazing thing. So the day school movement saved Judaism in America. Now, we have a long way to go because there are millions of unaffiliated Jews. But you do what you can. 10,000 here, 10,000 there, 10,000 here. It begins to add up eventually. We have to continue doing the work. Is it going to continue doing the work? At the urging of his father, the Moshe Soloveitchik, the Rav also organized an advanced institution called Heichal Rabbeinu Chaim Halevi and Yeshivat Torat Yisrael in 1939. To accommodate the influx of erudite European yeshiva students who were coming to America. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik felt that such learned students would challenge the Rav to fully utilize his capabilities as an expositor of rabbinic literature. The Rav delivered advanced Talmudic lectures to these select students and also arranged for the new immigrants to be tutored in the English language. Top of page 36. Rabbi Bernard Revel, the president of the yeshiva, later Yeshiva University, sent a group of the leading arrivals to Boston to study under the tutelage of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Agreement was reached between Rabbis Revel and Soloveitchik for the Heichal, this new institution, this yeshiva, to function as a branch of REITs of the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, the forerunner to Yeshiva University. In a subsequent letter to Revel, the Rav described the study schedule at the Heichal. Quote, at 7:30 a.m., morning prayers are held. Between 9 to 10:30 a.m., the English language is studied. From 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., the first Talmud study period is held. And from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m., the second Talmud study session takes place. My lectures are delivered to the students twice a week, on Mondays and Thursdays. End quote. The Heichal in Boston might well have developed into a postgraduate Boston branch of the New York Yeshiva. However, upon the deaths of Rabbis Revel and Moshe Soloveitchik, and the Rav's subsequent appointment to succeed his father as the yeshiva's senior Rosh Yeshiva, the Boston branch was soon terminated. I never knew any of this until I read it today. I never knew that there was a yeshiva established in Boston by Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rabbi Yechiel Michal Feinstein later attempted to maintain an advanced Torah postgraduate school in Boston. Rabbi Yechiel Michal, who was a nephew of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, later became the son-in-law of the Rav's uncle, Rabbi Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, otherwise known as the famous Brisker Rav, born 1886, passed away in 1960. He was the, well, like I said, the famous Revelvel, Rabbi Yitzchak Zev, the Grease, who took over on the passing of his father, Chaim Brisker, and continued the Brisker tradition in Jerusalem, where he emigrated, I think, in 1943 out of Europe. He ran to Israel. And he is, of course, obviously, the Brisker Rav, Rabbi Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, was obviously the brother of Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, hence the Rav's uncle. Now, the Boston Institute, now you see, that is like the second Feinstein-Soloveitchik marriage. The first one was Pesia Feinstein-Prejaner. She was the daughter of Rabbi Elia Prejaner. She married Moshe Soloveitchik. So Rabbi Yosha Ber Soloveitchik, the Rav's mother was a Feinstein, and Rabbi Soloveitchik's uncle, the Brisker Rav, married off his own daughter to another Feinstein. How about that? Pretty good, huh? The Boston Institution functioned for a short time until Rabbi Yechiel Michel Feinstein joined his uncle, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, at Masifta Teferet Jerusalem in New York. And what can I say? I'm delighted to see those three words linked like that, because that's the yeshiva that I attended on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, the Masifta Teferet Jerusalem, from K through 12 and beyond. So I got to look up that footnote one of these days. But Yechiel Michel Feinstein was only a name that I had heard growing up. I heard more about him, I think, when I went to Israel after college and heard of him that he had relocated from New York to Israel and started a yeshiva there. I just don't know too much about what yeshiva he started, where it was located, Yerushalayim, Bnei Brak. I simply don't know. But those of you who do, let me know. Okay, we're going to continue. There's more exciting stuff. Here we go. We got time. If you're listening, I'm right with you. Here we go. Fascinating stuff coming up here. You're going to love this. In 1935, the Rav journeyed to Palestine, where he was a candidate for the post of Ashkenazic Chief Rabbi of Tel Aviv. During this visit, he delivered Talmudic lectures and philosophical discourses at many of the yeshiv's advanced Torah and educational institutions. He also had an opportunity to meet the Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Palestine, Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, who died later that year. The Rav's discourse at Yerushalayim's Yeshivat Merkez HaRav, founded by Rabbi Cook, is described below by Rabbi Moshe Tzvi Neria, who was a student there at the time. This took place close to 100 years ago, in 1935. We're pretty close to that 100-year anniversary right about now, 11 years away, whatever it is, not that far off. So 90-plus years ago, here's what happened. In 1935, Rabbi Joseph Ber Soloveitchik went to give a shiur at the famous Yeshivat Merkez HaRav Kook in Jerusalem, Israel. It was known as Jerusalem, Palestine then. Here we go. Quote, "The Torah community of Jerusalem was privileged to a day of spiritual contentment and joy. One's heart skipped a beat upon seeing the announcements that Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik would deliver a lecture in Yeshivat Merkez HaRav. Immediately, the memory of Volozhin came to mind in all its glory and renown. As the years pass, the reputation of Volozhin only intensifies, and we are awed by the achievements of this exalted Torah institution. This chain of tradition now continues. It has passed from the Beis Halevi, the first Rabbi Yosef Ber, to his son Rabbi Chaim of Brisk. It has continued with Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. And now, we are greeting his son, our distinguished guest, the young Gaon, Rav Yosef Ber. The day of the lecture, many assembled at Merkez HaRav. Among them were the elder scholars who still saw the Volozhin Yeshiva in its glory. With them were the younger generation from the old Eitz Chaim Yeshiva and the new Chevron Yeshiva. These are students of the Netziv, of Volozhin. All wanted to ascertain whether the Brisker grandson was truly the heir to this intellectual dynasty. The Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Chalap, a native Jerusalemite, entered the auditorium. Following him was a tall young man with a large forehead, a black beard, and dark eyes. One could sense that he was engrossed in his own deep thoughts. The yeshiva delivered a few words of introduction, and then the guest began his discourse. To the August audience, he declared that, quote, "I am not here on my own merits, but because of the merits of my distinguished ancestry," end quote. The discourse then began with questions on the Talmudic text and the Maimonidean codification. The terminology was that of Reb Chaim, and the audience was totally caught up in this intellectual exposition. About one of his elucidations, the lecturer remarked, "I believe that I heard this concept from my grandfather." Yes, we also felt that we were hearing Reb Chaim lecture that day. After the lecturer's questions came a brilliant, logical, and clear analysis. New concepts and explanations were introduced, and gradually, all the questions were resolved. The lecturer held the audience spellbound for over an hour and a half. In truth, the House of Levi, the Beit HaLevi, did not disappoint our greatest expectations that memorable day. End quote. Some of the activists in the Tel Aviv community considered the Rav too young for the post of chief rabbi. His father attempted to alleviate their fears in a letter he wrote to Rabbi Yaakov Bauminger, the secretary of the Religious Council of Tel Aviv. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik declared as follows, quote, "I have heard that it is said that my son is too young. First, this is not true. He's between 30 and 40 years. In the previous generations, those possessing outstanding ability were already appointed to the most illustrious and influential rabbinical positions at such an age. They soon became the leading rabbis of their times. The elder rabbis coexisted with their younger colleagues in love and brotherhood, and they honored each other." End quote. Nevertheless, it was Rabbi Moshe Avigdor Amiel who was chosen as Ashkenazi chief rabbi Tel Aviv. Then in his prime, Rabbi Amiel was a prominent Mizrahi ideologist and the rabbi of Antwerp, Belgium. This is a good place to stop, because then we're going to get into his return from Israel to Boston. That was his only visit to the land of Israel. He got involved in local rabbinical activities. There's going to be some more cautious discussion. And then Rabbi Bernard Revel of YU is going to pass. Then Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, his own father, is going to pass. And there's a whole rumpus about who should take over. Is he qualified to take over for his late father? Or should he take over Rabbi Dr. Revel's position as president of the university? It was all up in the air at that time. We'll have a good look at it, God willing, next week during our weekly book club class. I want to thank everybody for calling in today. A big shagach. Hope you enjoyed learning about the kashrus problems that Rabbi Soloveitchik helped to solve. His great speech at Yeshiva Merkez Rav Kook, and his helping to create the Maimonides School in Boston, which changed Boston Jewry forever. Wishing everybody a great rest of the day and a great week, God willing. Come check us out tomorrow night, Tanakh Tuesday, where we will see Isaiah chapter 7 and what it has to say about 2 Kings chapter 16. You don't want to miss it. Everybody have a good day. Catch you tomorrow. Thanks for everybody for calling in. All the best. Bye for now.